Hello everyone, so I'm Bogdan Ganchev. Thank you very much for the invitation and a very warm welcome. Today I will talk about a project that Felicity Eperon, my supervisors George Santos and I have been working on recently. The motivation for it came from previous work on the stability of scalar or hairy curl black holes in asymptotically flat 4D. And in particular, that work gave us an idea for a scenario in which the weak cosmic censorship conjecture in asymptotically flat 4D might potentially be violated. And then we went on to investigate this setup, and this is what I will tell you about our investigation today. So here are the table of contents of my talk. So I will start in the introduction with a brief outline of the main ideas in our scenario. And then from section 2 onwards, I will start talking about more about our setup. And in particular, I will begin with a definition of the weak cosmic censorship conjecture. I'll give you a formal one and a slightly less formal one. And then I will present you some already known counterexamples to this conjecture so that you can get a better idea of what this is all about. And then afterwards, in section 3, we'll delve deeper into the details of our system and the main processes that dictate its evolution, namely super radiance and a gravitational wave emission. finally, I will sum up what we have said up to that point, and we'll talk about the possible end state of the system. And there is a hidden section 5 that you can see here that is just full of references. Okay, so let's begin. Oh, and by the way, you can always ask questions, so you can always stop me and ask questions. Okay, so our setup is entirely motivated by the so-called superradiant instability affecting curl black holes in the presence of a massive field. In our case, the field will be a scalar. You can do the same for a massive vector field, also known as a Proko field, for example. And it is probably good to say at this stage that superradiance itself exists for massless fields as well, but there it doesn't lead to an instability. Simply because once the particle scatters from the black hole, there is nothing to prevent it to escape to infinity. Whereas in the case of a massive term, due to the mass term, the space-time develops a region where the particle can get trapped and it can bounce back and forth between the black hole horizon and this trapping region and keep on extracting energy, hence leading to an instability. Now, this story has been known for quite some time. One thing that we found out in our work was that, in fact, for any non-zero rotation parameter of a curl black hole and for any scalar field mass, there is always a mode that will trigger superradiant instability in the system. That is, you can give me your favorite curl black hole as fast or as slowly spinning as you want, pick a scalar field mass to your liking, and I will be able to give you back a superradiant mode. Okay, now, as time evolves, these superradiant modes, they extract energy from rotational energy from the black hole and deposit into co-rotating scalar condensates around the black hole, also called scalar clouds. And these scalar clouds grow until the corresponding superradiant mode saturates. This saturation happens due to the spinning down of the black hole because energy is being extracted from it due to superradiance. One can show that, in fact, with increasing mode number for the scalar field, the growth rate of the superradiance decreases. And hence, one can then think that maybe some kind of a slow evolution of the system towards higher and higher mode numbers of the scalar field will proceed. There is a potential counter to this scenario, and this is the emission of gravitational waves by these scalar clouds that keep forming around the black hole. That is, if these clouds were to disperse faster due to gravitational wave emission than superradiance forms them by extracting energy from the black hole, then obviously this cascading towards higher mode numbers will not happen. In our own work, we show that we do not expect this to be the case, and indeed the system will slowly evolve towards higher and higher mode numbers. Now, eventually, all of the rotational energy of the black hole will be extracted and deposited into that sea of scalar clouds around it, and you'll be left with a Schwarzschild black hole in the center, surrounded by that sea of scalar clouds. Now one can then show that, in fact, massive scalar field perturbation of Schwarzschild black ground decay very, very slowly, and in fact, they decay so slowly, they decay so slow that it is suggestive of a development of a nonlinear instability at late times. However, there is a little subtlety that is to do with the fact that now here we don't have the super radiance anymore, so the emission of gravitational waves can actually maybe become important again. And we will have a more detailed discussion about this at the end of the talk. So, okay, this is the brief outline of what I'm going to tell you about, and now let's begin with the actual main part of the talk. Okay, so I'll first tell you what I'll first give you the formal statement of the weak cosmic censorship conjecture, then I'll give you one in simpler terms. But basically, so the weak cosmic censorship conjecture states that if you have some geodesically complete asymptotically flat initial data set, and you have some matter fields that obey hyperbolic equations and satisfy the dominant energy condition, then generically the maximum development of this initial data is an asymptotically flat space-time. In particular, it has complete scry plus, that is strongly asymptotically predicted. The word generically is in bold because it's an important word, and I'm not going to say anything about it now. In a few minutes, I hope it will become clearer when I give you some of the already known counterexamples to this weak cosmic censorship conjecture. Now, this is the formal statement. Usually when physicists talk about it, or at least where I'm coming from when they talk about it, they talk in a slightly different way about it. And this is that basically we start from some generic initial data, the weak cosmic censorship conjecture forbids the formation of naked singularities. That these are singularities that are in causal contact with some distant observer. Basically, these are places of space-time where physics breaks down, our physics breaks down that we know of, but you can still have information or a light ray propagate to a distant observer, which is something that we do not want in our theory, of course. Now, if you look at the simpler formulation, and if you look back at the formal one, so the formal one doesn't actually mention naked singularities anywhere. It is concerned with the maximum development of a space-time. Maximum development is of your space-time, is the region of space-time that you can uniquely predict from your initial data. And in here, this formation of a naked singularity is captured through that idea that such a formation will lead to an incomplete scry plus. So that's why this formulation you require a complete one. Okay. Now, so this both in its formal statement and in the informal one that I gave you, this is just a conjecture, it's not a theorem, and we actually already know of some counter examples to it. So I'll first start with higher dimensions, where higher dimensions for me means more than four. In particular, the example, first we'll start with the example of black strings in 5D. The famous simulation by Luis Lenner and Franz Pretorius, where they show that subject to the so-called Gregory-Laflamme instability, the black strings develop a self-similar structure suggestive of a pinch-off in finite asymptotic time, which will reveal the singularity inside the horizon to an outside observer for some period of time. Basically, what happens is that, you know, if you have this black string, as evolution proceeds, it slowly thins down, and spherical-like bulges form and drift apart, and the string in between them gets even thinner and thinner. New bulges form and drift apart, and then gets thinner and thinner, and eventually it gets so thin that, you know, you expect it to pinch off. Similar to, you can do that experiment with, you know, water tap, and you can just turn the water on and then slowly decrease it, and eventually you'll see that it randomly starts breaking at certain places. Anyway, this was black strings in 5D. Later, some people managed to achieve the same asymptotically flat setting in 5 and 6D, in 5D for black rings, and in 6D for single spinning Myers-Perry black holes. So the black rings, if you make them very, very thin, then you can imagine that if you zoom close to them, they will look exactly like a black string to you. So again, they are again subject to the Gregory-Laflamme instability, and the evolution proceeds in a very similar way. Whereas for the Myers-Perry black holes in 6D, there is no bound on how quickly, how much angular momentum you can give them. And if you make them spin very, very quickly, they thin out like pancakes or black brains, and then they turn out to also be subject to the Gregory Flamm instability, but in the radial direction. And a similar behavior is observed as in the previous two cases. Now, this is on higher dimensions. People have, of course, tried to violate the cosmic censorship, the weak cosmic censorship conjecture in four dimensions as well. And here, I hope, is where the word generic will become clearer. So a more formal way of saying what generic means is that if you introduce some appropriate norm on your space of initial data, then the set of initial data that violates the weak cosmic censorship conjecture will be of measure zero. The easiest way to illustrate this, at least for me, is through the example of critical collapse that was numerically done by Chopchuk and also mathematically by Christodoulou. I should probably say this paper here, it has three other papers as prerequisites to it, again by him, but they are all referenced in the very first sentence of that paper, so that's why I haven't written them there. Anyway, so what we have in this system is we have Einstein gravity, coupled to massless scalar field, which is spherical symmetry. You can construct one parameter family of solutions to this system, where this parameter is linked to the amplitude of the scalar field, and basically there is a threshold value for this amplitude, below which the scalar field just disperses to infinity, nothing interesting happens. Above it, it collapses, forms a black hole, and exactly the threshold value, which, you know, is one value out of infinitely many, you get a formation of a naked singularity, and, you know, this is clearly non-generic, hence why the word generic is in there. So this is a fine-tuned example. And I should probably say that a numerical simulation of critical collapse with no symmetry assumptions was recently carried out by those people.
Sorry.
Yes, go for it.
No symmetry assumptions, you mean even if you don't assume spherical symmetry, you can still have a naked singularity?
Sorry, I can't hear you.
So I was looking at the last reference.
Yes.
You say there is no symmetry assumption.
Yeah, they're not symmetric.
But yet you still get...
I'm not sure whether they get the... I'm not sure whether they themselves show that you can still get naked singularity, but in that one they still get the scaling relations, the same scaling relations that you have in this example. Yeah, I just gave it to show people that there where the disk has been done with no symmetric assumptions. Yeah, I think you would still get the... naked singularity formation. Okay. Now, the last example that I will tell you about is in 4D, is generic, and is in asymptotically ADS. So there, the authors work with Einstein gravity with negative cosmological constant coupled to a Maxwell field. And this Maxwell field lives at the boundary. The boundary is flat because they consider Poincaré patch of ADS, and this Maxwell field has only a time component. The motivation for this work came from a slightly earlier work, whereby it was noticed that if you take the amplitude of this vector potential at the ADS boundary to be a constant in time, then in the book you can find static zero temperature solutions, but up to a certain maximum value for this amplitude. Above this maximum value, you get naked singularities inside in the book. This, of course, immediately prompted the question, what will happen in a time evolution where you start from a configuration where your electric field, the electric potential at the boundary has a vanishing amplitude, and you slowly crank this amplitude with times until it goes past this threshold maximum value. Yeah.
So in your statement of weak cosmic centers, if you add the word asymptotically, but like explicitly?
Yeah, so there is a version for asymptotically ADS as well.
Yeah, so can you say what the version for ADS would be?
I don't remember exactly, but it will be something very similar to saying asymptotically ADS.
But it wouldn't require to put any restrictions on like what you do with the boundary or like how the field moves?
Well, there your initial value problem is slightly different, so we have to have certain conditions on the boundary, and then, yeah, you have to get something out of it. But, oh, you mean for the complete Scry Plus? Yeah, it's not going to be Scry Plus, of course, yeah.
Right.
It'll be something else, yeah.
That's the question.
With positive lambda, nothing interesting will happen, I suppose, in that specific case. I at the moment can't think of violations in asymptotic EDS. Somebody knows.
So this is unphysical, as far as
we research. Yes, it is unphysical, of course, yeah. But I mean, the five-dimensional asymptotically flat ones can also be unphysical.
That's doing this whole ABS CFT thing like we heard in some previous weeks.
Sorry? Yeah, it's just an interesting example. Well, the conjecture does the conjecture, you know, can be stated in with any. Yeah. Anyway, any other questions? Okay, so yeah, so this this time evolution was carried out numerically. And it was indeed found that as you go past this threshold amplitude from before, curvature starts growing unboundedly and, along the whole Poincaré horizon, and the weak cosmic censorship conjecture seems to be violated. An interesting, so the authors tried many different profiles for this this vector potential at the boundary, and they always found a violation, which meant that, you know, their example was generic indeed. And also another interesting thing compared to previous examples is that, so here we have large curvatures over large regions of space-time, whereas in all the previous example I told you about, for example, the pinching off of the black string, you get arbitrary large curvatures, but in an infinitesimally small region of space-time. So this was to say the first example where you can see a large violation, to put it that way. However, very soon after that, a possible resolution to this violation was proposed, and it was motivated by the so-called weak gravity conjecture, which I'm not an expert on, and I'm just in very simplistic terms. It basically states that if you have a theory of quantum gravity, in this theory of quantum gravity, you require to have particles with certain charge to mass ratio such that extremal black holes can decay. Now, what they were doing here, of course, is in a classical theory. So the authors had to translate this statement of weak gravity conjecture to their particular theory. And what this translates into was that they will have to include charge scalar fields in their system. They did that, and what this meant was now the static solutions, the static bulk solutions from before, became susceptible to charge superradiance, and a new family of solutions emerged at the onset of this superradiance, some hairy charge solutions that turn out to be regular for any value of the amplitude of the vector potential at the boundary, including past the maximum threshold value from before. And hence, one thing, so no time evolution has been performed for that case, but people assume that what will happen is if you were to do evolution again, including those charge scalar fields, once you reach this threshold value from before, you will just form this new family of solutions, and no arbitrarily growing curvatures will appear anywhere. One interesting thing to say is that the existence of these charge hairy solutions requires the charge of the scalar fields to be larger than some value, and this value that you get, this bound that you get, is the same as the bound that you get from the weak gravity conjecture. But we do not understand why this is. Okay, now these are all the counterexamples that we already know of that I will tell you about. This is not an exhaustive list, there are others that we know of. But I hope this has given you some idea of this whole program about violating the weak cosmic censorship conjecture. Okay, so next we move on to our proposal for a plausible counterexample in asymptotically flat 4D. And in particular, we are working with Einstein gravity, minimally coupled to a real massive scalar. The action is here, so psi is the scalar field, mu is the mass of the scalar field, r is the Ricci scalar. And in particular, we begin our analysis by considering massive scalar field perturbations on a fixed Kerr background. And we take an ansatz for our scalar field of this separable form, based on the background symmetries of the space-time. So omega is some complex frequency, And M is an azimuthal quantum number, an integer that labels the modes of the scalar field. The relevant equation of motion is the Klein-Gordon equation on a fixed Kerr background. So this box is computed with respect to the Kerr metric. And if you perform some standard analysis of boundaries and reflection and transmission coefficients, you can show that amplified scattering or superagents is indeed present in that system. That has been done in the 80s in some physics papers and more recently if you are looking for mathematical GR papers. So I've mentioned the word superagents a few times by now, and as I said, it is the one of something that we base our proposal on. So I think it is a good time to give you a very quick, lightning quick reminder of what superagents actually is. So superagents is a process that actually exists beyond black hole physics. For example, you can bound electromagnetic radiation off some conducting, rotating surface like a cylinder. And under certain conditions on the frequency, you get amplified waves. In black hole physics, superagency is linked to the presence of an ergo region in your space-time. So an ergo region is, like here, for example. So an ergo region is a region of space-time where observers are dragged along with space-time and they cannot remain at rest with respect to an observer, to another distant observer. And in textbooks, the usual way superagency is described is as the wave analog of the Penrose process, which most people have studied in their GR classes. And the Penrose process is a process of extraction of energy from a black hole by throwing matter into it in a special way, so the particle that comes out has more energy than the particle that you initially threw in. It's shown on this graphic that I borrowed from a paper. For me, the easiest way to imagine superagency is if you were to take a magnet attached to two long shafts, stick those two long shafts inside the ergo region with the magnet itself still being outside. Then those shafts, as I told you, will be made to co-rotate with the black hole because they're inside the ergo region. This will make also the magnet, which is outside of the ergo region, to spin. But then you can put this magnet inside some closed circuit or a coil, and this will, you know, lead to the production of electricity, and you can use this to do some work and extract. That way you extract energy from the black hole and you slowly spin it down. Okay, so that was my lightning quick introduction to what superagents is. Now, we have, as I said, we know that there is superagents in our system, so let's try to see what is its scale. To do this, we work in a certain regime. So we work in the regime where the azimuthal quantum number of the scalar field is large, that is, M is large. And we also set L equal to M. So what is L? So as I told you, our ansatz for the scalar field was separable. And in fact, with this ansatz, you can show that the Klein-Gordon equation of fixed Kerr background separates in radial and angular parts. And this other integer L is, so the integers L and M are the two integers that characterize angular dependence of your scalar field. Similar to how in spherical symmetry you have spherical harmonics with L and M, here you just have spheroidal harmonics with L and M. And we take L to be equal to M because we find that these are the dominant modes in the spectrum. Okay, and then you can do some hybrid double KB, Marshall Simplotin expansion procedure or whatever, and get a formula for the imaginary part of the frequency of the scalar field. Why the imaginary part? Well, I mean, so our ansatz was e to the minus I times omega times t, so it will be the imaginary part of omega that controls whether you have exponentially growing or exponentially decaying modes in time. And in particular, if omega, if the imaginary part is positive, then you have exponentially growing modes, that is, superagent modes. And this is the formula that we get. So what is what in this formula? So A is the rotation parameter, mu of the black hole, mu is the mass of the scalar field, the tilde denotes that these are dimensionless quantities, they've been made dimensionless with respect to the black hole radius. So for example, A tilde will be A over R plus. This F1 is some ugly function. The only thing you need to know about it is that it is always positive. This capital N is some non-negative integer that denotes the radial over tone. We just take it for zero in our case because we work with fundamental modes. Here, I've truncated this series, but we have more terms, but just for the sake of presence, I've truncated it. And okay, so we have this formula. So first of all, this is comparison of this formula with some numerical data. So this is the imaginary part of the frequency as a function of the azimuthal mode number of the scalar field. The blue dots are numerical data, and the red dashed line is this formula. It does agree very well, although I should probably mention that on the vertical axis there are 200 orders of magnitude. So unless, I don't know, I mean, it would be very hard for you to see any differences, to be honest. But we have checked that indeed our error in our formula agrees with our numerical data, and already for m below 10, like 5 or 6, the error is around 10%. Okay, so the formula agrees well with numerics. There are two things that you can note from this formula. So the first of all, so this exponential is always positive. This thing I told you is always positive. So the only thing that determines the sign of this omega is this sign. And in fact, you can see that for any scalar field mass and rotation parameter of the black hole, you can always make this sinh to be positive. You just have to take a big enough Mode number, L equal to M. And in particular, you can take the first integer that is bigger than this ratio, the ratio of the mass of the scalar field over the angular velocity of the black hole. Yes, go on.
The mass of the scalar field is zero. What happens to F1? The contribution out there goes away. It's an F1. What is F1? A square root comma zero.
I can't tell you, but it will still be some number. It will be always positive. But the thing that determines your oh no, sorry, yeah, no, I don't know what happens with F1 when mu is zero. Sorry, this term will disappear and you'll only be left with this, yeah. For master fields you can still have super radians, but you can also, so this can still be positive, but of course it can also be
negative. Difference between Einstein gravity.
Sorry, I can't hear you. Yeah, for a massless scalar field, you can still have super radians, but it's not going to lead to instability, yes. Okay. So you can always get super radians. And then if you look at this formula, the leading order term here is this e to the minus 4 L log L. Which basically tells you that different L modes evolve independently. They decouple from each other, they evolve independently. An easy way to see this, just take subsequent modes, take their ratio, and look at it in the limit of L going to infinity. And this is something that we'll use later. Okay, any questions? Okay. So now we have seen that there is super radians present in our system. We've determined its rate. And now we can combine this with the fact that because we have a massive field, there is a trapping region in our spacetime. A quick illustration of what I'm talking about is, so as I said already, the Klein-Gorn equation of fixed curve background separates in radial and angular parts. If you take the radial equation and you rewrite it as a Schrödinger-like equation, you get some effective potential, which is plotted here as this solid blue line. You can show the asymptotic value of this effective potential goes to the mass of the scalar field squared, which is this dashed dotted black line here. And as you can see, you get some trapping region here with this red dashed line indicating the energy of a typical trapped mode. And so if you were to take the mass of the scalar field to zero, for example, you'll see that this will disappear and then you will not have an instability because mode will not get trapped. Okay. Now, the presence of this trapping region leads to the existence of bound states of the scalar field that emerge to the onset of super radians. These are called scalar clouds. In particular, if you had a complex scalar field, for example, then you can show both numerically and also mathematically that in the full nonlinear theory, stationary solutions exist. And these are the so-called scalar-Harry curve black holes that I told you at the very beginning about. And they turn out, unfortunately, to be themselves unstable to higher modes of super radian, higher modes than the one that led, the one that led to their creation. And in this system, in the presence of a complex scalar field, one expects that slowly the system will evolve towards higher and higher mode numbers. Yes. However, we're not working with a complex scalar field, we're looking at a real scalar field, and for a real scalar field, there are no stationary solutions. The scalar clouds still form in the system, but now you expect that they will be subject to dispersal through gravitational wave emission. And of course, this immediately makes you ask yourself, is this gravitational wave emission efficient enough in order to prevent a cascade towards higher and higher Mode numbers, or is it not strong enough to do this? And in order to answer this question, we treat the scalar clouds as perturbing matter sources to our black hole, and we look at the Tuikovsky equation for gravitational perturbations. So this is the Tuikovsky equation schematically. I have not written it in its full glory. D is some differential operator. Psi 4 is what we are solving for. It's a Newman-Penrose scalar that gives you the outgoing gravitational radiation. And T4 is some linear combination of projections on a null tetrad of the scalar field tensor. Okay, now if you know Psi 4, that's the outgoing gravitational radiation, Tuikovsky taught us how to extract the emitted gravitational radiation at infinity, spatial infinity, and this is given by this formula here, where omega GW is the frequency of the gravitational waves. And if you go to the maths, you see that this is equal to 2 times the real part of the frequency of the scalar field. Now, we work with this rescaled expression because it is independent of the amplitude of the scalar field. M is the mass of the black hole, and this curly M of S is given by this formula here. It basically gives the total energy in a given scalar cloud. So as I said earlier, the different L equal to M modes decouple from each other, hence we can treat them independently and look at their back reaction independently, and this is exactly what we do here. We compute this expression for every different L equal to M mode with a different cloud as the source, and we compute this quantity. Okay. Now, you might wonder, at this stage, you might look at this and think, okay, wait a second, so super radiance is something that proceeds on an exponential timescale, whereas what you've shown here, whatever the numbers are, is something that goes polynomially with t. So what are you trying to do? Basically, the only thing that we want to see is that this thing decreases as a function of m, because then we would know that whatever happens, as a function of time, the gravitational wave emission will have no way of counteracting the exponential growth due to super radiance. Okay, so here are our results. So we have way less points than for the Klein-Gordon equation because the Tuikovsky one is way harder to solve. Oh, we also have a second set of points. So Pj is the same as P, just for angular momentum. What we see is that, yeah, indeed, it seems that the gravitational wave emission decreases as a function of m. Hence, we do not expect that it will be able to prevent the cascading towards higher Mode numbers due to super radiance. Yes, do you have a question?
Yeah, so I guess the stability rate is also increasing as a function of m. Right?
Sorry?
The stability, like omega I, is also decreasing as a function of m. Right? So do you have an estimate for sort of when the switch happens for the characteristic gravitational dissipation timescale being small compared to like the growth timescale, like that's subsequent of the one higher n mode?
No, but we know that at late times, for high enough m's, eventually it will happen, right? So you just have to, you might need to wait very, very long indeed.
Yeah,
so
but that would just be interesting because I think the opposite is true for like m equals 1 or 2 or something, right? Is that true?
For m equals 1 or 2, well, it's just true.
That if you grow m equals 1 cloud, then it'll actually dissipate before you go the m equals 2 cloud. Is that right?
Let me think about the numbers. I think it depends which part of phase space you are, but yes, I think it might be possible, yes.
I'm really interested in where this switchover happens. I mean, in particular for like the astrophysical systems.
For astrophysical systems,
like,
yeah, I don't know.
If those timescales weren't too crazy long, then you'd actually expect some, like in the intermediate regime where you've grown one cloud and now you're growing the second one before the
first one has time to dissipate.
Mm-hmm.
You'd expect again to have two M modes populated simultaneously, so you'll get some character, like some characteristic gravitational wave signal, it'll be sort of the combination of those two clouds oscillating.
Yeah. So first of all, for us, we work with nearly extremal black holes. Second of all, yeah, I mean, in a realistic situation, what you're saying, there will be a lot of. We neglect the gravitational the radiation that goes back into the black hole, because that's technically subleading. But you know, in a realistic situation, you have one whatever modes you have in whatever situation. I think at any stage that can happen. Have one mode grows and saturates, but then obviously to slowly decaying, and some of it to leak back into the black hole and make it spin a little bit faster for a very short period of time, which will make this mode again active for a little bit. In the meantime, the other mode will be growing, and there will be some transient period where actually you have the slower mode growing, whereas the other mode will be just oscillating up and down.
Transferring.
But at late time frame for large amps, you expect these things to be very, very subleading.
So I'm just wondering if you had
No, we don't have exact large numbers.
Is large enough for this to be true?
No, we don't have. But as I said, we also work in the limit, everything we do, we work in the limit of M large, so, yeah. Yeah, go on.
Radiation waves correspond to what we call monopole radiation.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
Monopole radiation.
Yes, what about monopole?
TR is just as quadrupole radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Dipole radiation, monopole radiation. So what you're saying that when the black holes merging, for example, you would detect scalar as well as dipole radiation.
I mean, if you have some scalar matter or in your binary merging system, I'm sure you can detect gravitational waves from the scalars. Yes. Yeah, but they're not made of scalars, are they? Yeah. Yeah.
So the states he's considered here have frequency that's less than the mass, so they're bound states, so that's why they don't.
Wait, what? I'm not sure I understood your question. Okay. Any other questions? So Psi4 is, as I said, is a Newton Penrose scalar. So it is actually some component of the Weyl tensor. Hence, we can use it to measure space-time curvature as well. We do this by monitoring this quantity here, which is, again, rescaled by the total energy of the scalar cloud, so that it is independent of the amplitude of the scalar field. And we look for the maximum of this quantity over our whole space-time. And what we see is this. So there are three lines here. So first of all, the numerical data is the orange dots. We have five here, one more than the previous plot, because it's slightly easier to extract than the previous quantity, which is at infinity. It's very tiny. We have two more lines. So the dashed blue line here is some leading order approximation, similar to what we did for the superalien growth rate, which goes as L to the minus 16. Whereas the red dashed line is the next leading order approximation, which already agrees very well with the data. They also both approach the same value, which is important. As you can see from this, it seems that we don't have enough to talk to know whether there will be arbitrary growing curvatures or not at late times. At least from Psi4 and the component of the Weyl tensor that we're looking at. The only thing that one remains to figure out is, then what happens with these scalar clouds? So it doesn't seem like anywhere inside them, you know, some energy density or whatever will lead to something blowing up. So what happens with the scalar clouds? This is what I will tell you next. Okay, so let's first have a quick recap of what we've seen up to now. So given any spinning curve black hole and a scalar field of any mass mu, you can always find a mode in the system that will trigger superradiance. Hence, what happens if you consider some initial data for your Einstein scalar system? So for us particularly, we consider initial data such that for the gravitational sector, we take something that is close to Kerr, with deviations from Kerr being small in some appropriate norm. Whereas for the scalar field, we take a profile that has support over all, of course, all the stable and unstable modes. Now, the stable modes will decay with time, so they're not interesting. And the late time dynamics of the system will be entirely dictated by the L equal to m superradiant modes, which are the dominant modes in the spectrum. And this allows us to write our scalar field in this way, where this coefficient here in this infinite series is basically depends on your choice of initial data. So for example, if you were to have analytical data, you know, which is very unrealistic, this will be some e to the minus alpha times L, where alpha is some positive constant. If we were to have some less regular data, for example, finite Sobolev norm, this will be some polynomial in L, 1 over L, 1 over L squared, something like this. Okay, and as I already said, the different L equal to M modes evolve in decouple and evolve independently from each other, so we can treat them. We can treat them separately. Anyway, so and what we saw is that okay, so you know the cloud, so these modes stabilize one by one, forming clouds around the black hole, and eventually, you know, all the rotational energy of this black hole will be extracted and deposited into scalar clouds around it, and you'll be left with some Schwarzschild black hole at the center, surrounded by a sea of scalar clouds. Now, this thing happens as t goes to infinity in our regime of large M, so it's in asymptotic time. But once you reach this Schwarzschild black hole surrounded by a sea of scalar clouds, you can go back to what we did before and look at this time massive scalar field perturbation, but on a Schwarzschild background. So before that we looked on a fixed Kerr background, now we look on a fixed Schwarzschild background. You can do the same calculation as we did for the superradiant growth rate. Well, not exactly the same, but similar. And in fact, it turns out that the answer that you get is equivalent to if you were to just set A equal to zero in our previous formula, which is what you would expect. And now the answer here, I've just given you the important parts of it, not the whole formula again, but in the what you see is now this singe that we had that could change sign now takes on a definite sign and it becomes negative, and the imaginary part of the frequency for mass scalar field perturbation on Schwarzschild is always negative, which is what you would expect because Schwarzschild does not have an ergo region, hence you do not expect superradiance there. Furthermore, what you also see is that the leading order term in this expression is still this e to the minus 4 L times log L. Now, what you can use this for is you can take this expression and use it to put a bound on the decay of late time perturbations, massive scalar field perturbations on a Schwarzschild background. So there is a proper mathematical way of doing it. Described in this paper by Joe Keir. But if you were to a hand wavy way of saying what you do is you basically get back to this expression, put in for this omega what we had on the previous slide, and then here you take the best case scenario, this exponential, some analytical data, so e to the minus alpha times L where alpha is a positive number. You convert this sum to an integral, and then you try to estimate that integral. And what you will see is that it turns out that perturbations, mass scalar field perturbations on Schwarzschild background have to decay at late times slower than 1 over log of t, which is very slow. So in particular, that's slower than any polynomial in t. And it is in fact so slow that for people trying to prove stability of such systems, this indicates that there is some kind of a nonlinear instability present in the system. Now, there are a few caveats that have to be set here. So first of all, this is not 100% proof that there will be a nonlinear instability in the system. It is highly suggestive of such. you can actually do more, and you can show what you expect. You can show that you can get a little bit more information on linear stability in the sense that you can show that you do not expect that you can find anywhere in the linear spectrum growing modes. But what you expect to happen is that stuff will be orbiting around for so long that it will slowly clump up until back reaction becomes significant enough that you expect maybe black holes to form or something to happen. Now, however, there is also another thing you might wonder about. So this is very, very slow. Before we had superradians that was competing with the gravitational waves, and superradians was proceeding on an exponential time scale, the gravitational wave emission had no chance of doing anything. But now we have this very slow decay, and it is completely acceptable to ask, so, okay, is it not possible then that this all those clouds that you get around the black hole, they'll just disperse the gravitational wave emission before any issues from the slower than logarithmic decay due to nonlinearities will become apparent in the system. So for example, you can think of a point particle going around the black hole. We know that in this case, whether there will be any nonlinearities or not, it will emit some gravitational waves, and then it will eventually plunge into the black hole, and that's it. Nothing more interesting than that will happen. Now, in the point particle approximation, you can't account for this slower than logarithmic decay. And in our approximation, we can't get an estimate on the late time gravitational wave emission, just because our approximation breaks down, because you get negative energy. You basically have some E0 minus something small times t, and when you take t to infinity, you get a negative value. So this doesn't work. So basically, the fate of our scenario depends on which of the two competing factors, whether it will be the gravitational wave emission or the issues due to the nonlinear issues due to the slower than logarithmic decay will win over. And if it was the latter, if it was the nonlinearities winning over, then we don't know of a possible stationary endpoint end state to the evolution of this system. And in particular, you can envisage that you eventually reach a regime where you need more than effects beyond classical GR in order to determine the evolution of the system, which will be against the spirit of the weak cosmic censorship, because you've started with some well-defined classical initial data.
So for the gravitational wave emission question,
yes,
like you showed it for the first few M's, and then were you fitting some trend to that and extrapolating that to higher?
Oh, you can even get an analytical formula. So we have certain things we haven't written them down, but the problem is that then you have to sum all of those, and you have to take it at late time, and then the approximation breaks down.
So the estimate for the scaling with large L of the gravitational wave emission.
It's something exponential with M, but I can't remember exactly what. It doesn't, as I said, whatever it is, it doesn't help you because approximation breaks down at late time. So it can be any number. It's not going to give you the correct estimate if you were trying to estimate somehow. Or at least I don't know how to do that. But that was the talk. Thank you.
Sorry, so if there is indeed nonlinear stability and you have small black hole forming in this scalar hair, why this would be a violation of weak cosmic censorship?
Well, because for the black hole to form, you have to reach some very high, you reach regions of space and you have very large curvatures. So basically, another way of saying it is, give me a scale at which you expect quantum gravity effects to kick in. I'll be able to give you a time at which you have to consider those. And this is against in the weak cosmic censorship conjecture, you expect to start with some classical data, and have some classical well posed problem, and then you evolve it and you get something else.
Now you're talking about quantum gravity, right? But this is all classical.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You expect that due to those nonlinearities, you reach a regime where you need quantum effects to predict the future of the system.
So isn't that good though? Like, because we would be saying that quantum gravity is not behind an horizon, right?
Yeah. Oh, but this is what you expect in all the examples of car violations. To you know, you expect that you know whatever those violations are, they get corrected by quantum gravity. Like for example, so what I showed you with the example in ADS. So if you were to do that in a full quantum gravity theory, what you expect to see is once you crank this amplitude of this boundary vector potentials, eventually the electric fields inside will get so large inside the bulk that you get pair Schwinger pair creation, and you know pairs of particles start appearing, and you know nothing big or drastic will happen. So yeah, and
still a good thing, I guess. I mean, like quantum gravity is not hidden from us. If these all these things actually happen, if you do have these violations, that means that quantum gravity is like you can actually see it.
Yeah, well, that's the idea why you try to do that, to see what goes wrong and then what resolves it, hopefully.
Yeah, so I didn't quite understand your answer to Juan. So, I mean, could you just paint us a little picture of what your scenario is for where these this non-linear instability actually causes arbitrarily high curvature without being hidden behind some like small black hole or something like that? Sitting around there, it's not decaying. Maybe it's due to self-gravity, it starts condensing or something like that. That's like the non-linear effect. And then I would guess that as soon as it, you know, becomes condensed enough where it satisfies the Hoop conjecture or something, then you get a black hole forming. If that's what happens.
Yeah, well, so one thing that we did that I haven't shown here is, so we looked at, so it seems like the clouds localize in the radial direction. But they don't. But the angular direction, the sphere grows faster, and so we try to make some estimates of where you might get black hole formation. But it seems that the energy density never gets large enough for you to get a black hole. So if these nonlinearities are going to do something, I don't know exactly what they will do. But we presume that what might happen is that eventually you have regions where you have, you know, very large energies, but you still, I can't tell you exactly whether you get black holes to form or not. The only thing I'm telling you is that if you, you know, if you have these nonlinearities really happening and, you know, leading to bad stuff happening, that you can give me any energy scale and I'll eventually be able to tell you after this time you need to consider more than just classical GR to resolve the evolution of the system. Now, this doesn't, for example, go against the, you know, proper form mathematical definition with cosmic centership conjecture. But from my point of view, you know, if you start with some classically well-defined system and then you suddenly need more than classical effects to resolve its future, that's against the spirit of what the conjecture was designed for.
But so here you'd be appealing to some kind of Hoop conjecture type argument, saying that he's...
Yeah, we're trying to do some Hoop conjecture type argument, yeah.
Form a black hole,
yeah.
Form a high curvature.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Mark?
I mean, maybe it's a silly question, but you said, you know, you were doing all those calculations in the large L equals M regime, but most of your plots were like M equals 0, 1, 2.
Yeah, for the Tarkovsky equation, we have more points, but the ones that, you know, are like within good convergence and stuff are those, yeah. But we also have some analytical work. Yeah, but what's your question anyway?
I mean, I guess M equals 0 or M equals 1 doesn't seem to be large, like in the large M regime, right?
Yeah, well, but we also have some analytical...
I guess that's the question, yeah.
Oh, so the question is how much we can trust what I'm saying. Oh, okay, yeah. I mean, so for the gravitational wave emission, as I said, we have very few points. But we have some estimates that I haven't shown here. So we have one more point that I haven't shown. We have some estimates which seem to agree with this. But for example, here you can see that, so this is just, you know, we have some analytical approximation to psi 4. And whatever, and what we have is very, very accurate. So, and agrees with, you know, and the numerics agree with what we have. So we expect that our results will hold. As much as we've checked, everything seems to agree.
Okay. Any last questions? No, let's thank Mark again.
Thank you.